Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis and also Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C. I'm so glad to say that this is our second year doing live show at the Central Eurasian Studies Society's annual conference. We are so excited about the invitation and for this partnership. Thank you, CES. So today we are going to follow kind of unusual format, speakers on the stage and I'm behind the microphone in public. If technology permitting, let's make it even more unusual. So what I have in mind is to turn the conversation into a group discussion where you ask the question and I enjoy listening. However, this will be on the record conversation. It will be published as usual on Sunday. So today we are here to discuss the role of women in politics, in governance, in contemporary Central Asia. Our intention is to talk and understand what role do they play and what power do they have in today's decision-making process in Central Asia. We will also ponder around how is it compared to the Soviet times, the challenges and opportunities for women coming into politics, and what does it tell us about tomorrow. But in the meantime, like many other unknowns in Central Asia, we don't have much data about this topic, but I'm confident in my panel's ability to break it down for us. So let's get started by introducing the panel here at the stage. I am joined by Dr. Jennifer Murtazashvili, a political science professor at the University of Pittsburgh. Among others, she's also the author of Informal Order in the State in Afghanistan. She closely follows the entire region. Mohira Sayarkuluba is with us today, and she comes from all the way from Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, where she works as a researcher, educator, feminist, and LGBTQT activist. And Dr. Sarah Hummel is joining us, who's the visiting professor of governance at the Harvard University. She teaches governance with background in Eurasia. Umida Hashimova is with us. She is originally from Uzbekistan, Central Asia, and currently affiliated as a writer and researcher within the Strategic Studies Division of CNA. And Bruce Panier is joining us from Prague. You can see him on the screen. He's the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia, below Kishlok, Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us. And let's give our speakers a big applause. By the way, thank you to you, our audience, for your participation. It's so nice to be in your company. Okay, let's get started with you, Umida. Are you satisfied from the role women play in today's political life of your country, Uzbekistan?
Yeah, being kind of growing up in Uzbekistan and living there and working there and covering now Uzbekistan, yes. As you said, I will be more kind of opposed to speak about Uzbekistan and the role of women. So what's the role of women in Uzbekistan? Well, of course, as in any Central Asian countries, their representation is way below of its potential, right? So their leadership kind of space remains very limited. And if you think about the pyramid, that's how their representation is. They are a lot more in the bottom. And as the pyramid goes up, the kind of leadership role kind of goes up, it's less and less. And that's when you compare with our Uzbekistan's neighbor, right, Afghanistan, the situation is pretty kind of, in the comparison, is does not look favorable for Uzbekistan when you have a 100% literacy rate in Uzbekistan, almost 100%, and you have a women work enforcement, participation of women work enforcement almost like a 53%, and in Afghanistan was 18% literacy rate, you have like 43% of labor kind of participation. So that's kind of shows that so much potential is not utilized in Uzbekistan, although, which is interesting, I looked at the statistics for U.S. and the labor participation for women in the U.S. is not actually much higher, it's like 56%. So there's not, it's not much difference, but still much lower. When we think about women in the leadership, we think about Senate, right? We think about the in the parliament, yeah. And if you look there, the percentage of women there is only collectively, so we're talking about 250 people, right? 100 in Senate and then 150 in the Parliament, is only roughly 15%. That's interestingly, yesterday the Speaker of the Senate, the only woman in history, she said that, well, we want to bring it to the 40%. So it's more than doubling the number of the women participation, right? And okay, I mean, if it's good that they're setting these numbers, maybe they will not reach the 40%. At least if they can reach 30% in 10 years, that would be a kind of huge gain. Well, you would ask, well, why did Uzbekistan ended up in this situation, right? Why are there so few women in the government? Well, I think there's actually no desire to promote women to leadership positions. I mean, again, desire, it's again male politicians. There's no public service law in Uzbekistan, meaning that, being in a leadership position, particularly in the government in Uzbekistan, it's a pretty brutal area to work, right? So you have rude male politicians, right? They can keep meetings until midnight at night, and they use profanity, right? Sometimes they use force. So, I mean, we see this in the past three years. We see this news coming, how they treat their, how politicians treat their officials. So it's a very brutal place to work. So women are not really attracted to go and work in there. And because in particular, it's a conservative society, right? Their role is mainly is to kind of confined within the house, being a good wife, and then being a good mother.
Okay, thank you, Umida. So let me clarify that. What you're saying is because of the tough working environment, women might not be very attractive to political positions. So it is not about the opportunity, but women might not be willing to join this competitive working environment. Is it what you are trying to say?
Definitely. I don't think even men are attracted to work in the government. I would say it's a very heroic move sometimes men do to work in the government. Therefore, like, I mean, who wants to stay until midnight and listen to a rude official? I mean, work this long hours during the day, right? And not knowing, while usually as a woman grew up, most probably you're married.
Let's take another view on this from a different perspective, Kyrgyzstan, where women are indeed competitive and indeed occupied highest political positions, like Rosa Otunbayeva, who once ruled the country as the president and did a pretty good job, I should say. So here you have a view from Uzbekistan, Mohira, saying that perhaps it might be women who are not attracted to work in public offices because it's tough and working environment is harsh. So how is this in your country, Mohira?
I think it's not for the lack of interest that women are poorly represented in the places of power. I think we have a structural issue here where women and the work they do is devalued in the society. And Mary Beard, who wrote a book about women in power, said that when we start seeing women in large numbers in any kind of institution, that probably means if we still exist in a, you know, conditions of patriarchal society, that probably means that that place is no longer where power is. So we kind of have this impasse, right? Where and we see that also with a lot of professions. Yeah, as soon as women in large numbers enter any profession, that profession immediately is seen as less skilled, as less qualified, as you know, less valuable. The salaries go down. So it's not. I don't think it's fair to say that, you know, women don't go into politics because they're not interested. And we see, you know, this kind of structural barriers everywhere where, like, the workplaces are not suitable for workers who take care of children or elderly, or there are no welfare institutions that would support, you know, workers who have responsibilities outside of work, right? So the ideal worker is always assumed to be a man who has somebody who is doing all this reproductive labor, right? Then there's, of course, the wage gap. There's a glass ceiling. There is a list of professions that are banned for women, right? Women are officially, by labor codes, prohibited from going into a number of professions which happen to be you know, very well paid professions, highly skilled professions. So yeah, in Kyrgyzstan, of course, all the gains that have been made, they did not just happen. You know, power is never granted, it's always taken. Yeah, it's always a result of a struggle. So yeah, women in Kyrgyzstan have worked very hard to gain the quotas in the parliament, to gain the quotas in the local Knesset.
Even though you have had a woman president and various other roles filled by women, and you still think, Mohira, women are still far from being an equal partner in decision-making in political life of Kyrgyzstan?
Sure, and that is not enough to just be represented formally in the, you know, the institutions of government. Women have to be paid equally for equal work. Women have to have equal educational opportunities. Women have to have access to all sorts of professions.
Thank you very much. Let me bring in Sarah and Jennifer, you in the discussion. So you got kind of two opposite pictures about the topic we are discussing today. How you compare the rest of the region on this topic? Also, whenever you talk about women's role, people tend to refer to the Soviet times as an example when Central Asian women were liberated. So how you compare women's role in today's Central Asia with the Soviet times?
So I think this is a really good question, and it's if we look at what's happened in Central Asia over the past 25 years, we see changes, right? So it leads us to ask, so yes, women were more visible, they played a more public role, and if that changed so quickly, if a lot of that was reversed, then we have to ask ourselves how meaningful, right, that change, what was going on during the Soviet period. Were women promoted to certain positions for, you know, how effective are these quotas? And quotas have different effects in different kinds of political contexts. So in the Soviet period, it was authoritarian. So women were forced, right, in many situations to play certain roles into certain positions. But they were also relegated to certain areas as well. So you had the women's committees, right? I mean, there were these places where women, it was acceptable for women to congregate and to work. And if we look at, to contrast this actually to what we see in Afghanistan, where I've done some research on women, and actually it's where I've done most of my research on women's issues, if we contrast sort of how the Soviet Union behaved to how international donors behave in Afghanistan, I think we begin to see sort of similar dynamics, is that gender and issues of women became a real preoccupation for the international intervention in Afghanistan. And so the gender quotas did result in a lot of meaningful change. But people right now in Afghanistan, for example, are very, very concerned about whether these advances for women will be rolled back if the Taliban come to power, if there's a power-sharing agreement or something like that. And where do these concerns come from? They come from very similar dynamics to what we saw, I think, in the Soviet period. And I'd be curious to see if my colleagues agree or disagree with this assessment of the Soviet period. But there's a sense that their representation is very much supported by the international community, just as it was for the Soviet government. And without these kinds of supports, will women be able to continue in these positions? And so I've done some research in interviewing women leaders to try to understand how they achieved their roles in society, economic leaders, business leaders. I worked with an Afghan colleague, Arya Najat, and we interviewed pop stars and to understand these wide range of women leaders and how they emerged. And they all said that they came to their positions not because of government support, because they had the strong support of people in their families. And this is sort of underlying, and these are sort of mega leaders, right? These are like really important social change actors. And I do wonder how much of the, so yes, Afghanistan has actually exceeded its quota in parliament. There's more women, the 25% quota, and I think there's now like 30-35% women in parliament, which is surprising and amazing. And now you see women in urban centers very active in politics. And I'm wondering if we're seeing sort of a very similar situation to what we saw in the Soviet period, where you see an urban-rural divide between, you know, women in political leadership and those who are not. But then there's a whole other dimension. We're talking about women in politics, and something I'd like to direct our attention to is women in rural areas and how women can be active in politics there. And I've recently done some survey work in Tajikistan trying to understand local governance issues. And it's really interesting because when I did a survey there, I asked the survey firm, For a representative sample. And when you do a representative sample, you imagine your sample comes back something like 50-50 men and women. And they say, well, if you want 50, do you want 50-50 or do you want a representative sample? I said, well, of course I want a representative sample. And they said, well, because if you want 50-50, we're really going to have to oversample men because of migration. I said, no, I just want to see who's out there. So the survey comes back. Would you believe the gender sample during the summer 2016 in Tajikistan, it's close to 70-30. 70% women, 30% men. What kinds of effects does this have on local politics and leadership? Turns out a lot of women are now Mahala leaders. And they're doing this work, and not only are they doing this work informally, now they're recognized formally for doing this. And the Mahala in Tajikistan is very different from the one in Uzbekistan. It doesn't have the same governmental status. To me, this is really interesting. What are the long-term effects of something like this, right? And one of the things we're doing right now is analyzing this data to see if, like, women Mahala leaders are better able to provide public goods in their communities than male leaders.
So is this Mahala level change is having any implication on women's participation in the national politics in Tajikistan, Jen?
So this is a question, I think, for all of us. It's a question that we need to be thinking about. Migration is such a huge issue throughout the region, and I think migration affects women, right, in so many different ways. Women are in some countries like Kyrgyzstan, women are migrating much more than they are in Tajikistan or Uzbekistan. That's having a huge effect on families. But I think that's actually a question that we need to be thinking about very seriously as we think about women in politics in the region.
Please feel free, Sarah, to add anything you would like to add into what we have been talking about so far. Also, I'm kind of unclear as to what we are talking about today about the role of women in governance or politics. Are we talking about a progress or a setback when compared to the Soviet time?
So I think I'll pick up on the quotas, which has been mentioned, which I think is important. I've done most of my research in Kyrgyzstan, and there is a 30% quota on party lists. So when a party submits their list of candidates, there have to be at least 30%. Every fourth person on the list has to be a woman. But this doesn't actually translate into the kind of representation in the parliament that we would expect. And this is for a couple of reasons. The first is that between the election and actually sitting down, a lot of people are removed from that party list, and women tend to be removed at a higher rate than men. And so when it comes to getting out seats, there are fewer women on that are getting these seats because there's fewer women high up on the list. And second of all, once women actually take their seats in parliament, they're more likely to leave for other reasons. So they leave the parliament early. Some of this is not a bad thing. Some of this is because they're moving on to other positions in the government and possibly representing promotion. But in some cases, this is them leaving or being pressured to leave and telling these stories of being pressured to leave. And the result of this is that despite the quota, we're not seeing that kind of representation of women in Kyrgyzstan. And so just recently in August, a gender quota was introduced for the local government in Kyrgyzstan. And there, the approach is a little bit different, and the approach is on at the mandate level. So saying that, you know, we should have a set number of women actually on the local Kanesh, as opposed to the party list. And this, I think, is a big step forward, recognizing that party list quotas don't work as effectively as quotas on actual seats for getting women into these local councils. Now, there has been some backlash against the new quota, the new gender quotas in the local areas. And I think that is a place where it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out and to see whether there is ultimately support for this, because these are areas where representation of women has historically not been very high. It was only, I think, about 10% in 2018 of members of these local Kaneshas were in fact women, which is very low. And so to see whether this sort of formal law now changes things will be, I think, a very interesting and telling story of how we're moving, whether we actually are moving in a good direction or not.
I see Mohira raising her hands. Yes, please. I really encourage this type of interaction. Please go ahead, Mohira.
I just wanted to add that with all this focus on quotas, of course, it's important to have, you know, the numbers represented. But I think we should focus more on what we want women in politics for, mm-hmm. right? And behind all this talk about quotas, we tend to forget, you know, that I mean, women may very well be present in power, but what kind of policies are they pushing through, right? We've seen how conservative women politicians have pushed very anti-women policies in the past. So, you know, we have to think sort of beyond the identity politics. We've seen, for instance, you know, that a lesbian prime minister can be, you know, pushing forward a fascist agenda, basically, right? Which is anti-women, anti-LGBT. So I think, yeah, well, historically, we have to recognize that it was, you know, the progressive politics, the politics on the left that have been most beneficial for women and, you know, other minorities.
That's very interesting what you are saying, Mohira, in terms of need for change. In the context of Central Asia, though, where women's role in leadership is very low in general, but in Kyrgyzstan, as I said, you had a women president, which is to say there's not a country in Central Asia which was or which is more better positioned to make these kind of changes that you are talking about. And yet, apparently, things are not changing or not to the extent that you would like to see this happening. I wonder what has to happen so that those changes occur. Who can even make it happen if a women president couldn't?
Once again, we see that oftentimes women are called into the positions of power in the time of crisis, when they have to come and sort out the mess that, you know, was created before them. So it's always, you know, you cannot win kind of in this type of situation. So I think, yeah, the fact that Kyrgyzstan did have a female president, it's a good thing, but I don't think we cannot really celebrate it as a big victory, yeah, for women.
Okay, let's bring in Bruce Panier here. Bruce, it's a complicated picture. Let me give you some numbers and get your thoughts on it. So in 1990, there were 8 women in the Turkmen parliament, versus today there are 31 female members. So things are not as grim as it might sound, at least from the perspective of Turkmenistan. But interestingly, in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, things seems to be opposite, where in 1990, there were 48 women in the parliament, versus today, there are only 24. So what does it tell you about the role of women in independent Central Asia?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's been male-dominated politics since the collapse of the Soviet Union in a lot of these places. I was reading some of those papers from Open Democracy this week, which were great, by the way. But I remember there was one term that was used, it was re-traditionalization, which I found to be absolutely appropriate to the situation here. People are trying to get back to their Islamic roots, but they're interpreting that as having to mean women have to get these secondary and tertiary roles in society, or back to what they assume is a traditional role for women. So it's really been a minus for women in a lot of places, and certainly in the political arena, I would say. You know, that said, there has been some successes. I would still say that you use the example of Turkmenistan. Well, you know, they do think there's not a women in parliament, but we'll know that the Turkmen parliament is a rubber stamping body, and this is practically tokenism. The last 2 speakers of the parliament in Turkmenistan have been women, and I imagine that is an attempt by the government to show that women should be at least included in politics to the point where they support the current government. You know, Uzbekistan just has a woman speaker now. She hasn't even been in for 4 months, but that's, you could, I suppose, regard that as a sign of progress. You mentioned Rosa Utunbayeva, and of course that is a great sign. I would also add to the comments that were made about her that she's the only Kyrgyz president, except for the incumbent, who hasn't fled the country or had charges leveled against them. So that says something about women in politics, where at least in Rosa's case, she seems to be a lot cleaner than any of the other Kyrgyz presidents we've seen to date. So there's a couple other things in here. I wanted to mention on the topic of re-traditionalization, that, Kyrgyzstan, although that is a more liberal, so you would think it would be easier to work with within the confines of Kyrgyz politics.
Ovida, I see you are raising your hand, so please go ahead with your intervention to Bruce.
Yeah, not intervention. It's really, I mean, we have, I think one thing we need to remember when we're talking about quotas, it's a really push from top, right? But we need to always think about, this cannot push from top, cannot never actually happen from the push up and then changes from the bottom. What does it mean? It means that the society actually needs to change. They need to the attitude toward the like women violence, gender equality, that those kind of changes need to happen. I mean, women, I don't know about other countries, but I know in Uzbekistan have very little protection. What happens when a female is abused in a family? That happens very often. I mean, she goes and lives with her mother or lives with someone and then comes back to the same abusive husband, right? How can we talk about women empowerment unless we solve those problems? Another issue is women themselves need to change. I mean, we're talking about traditional society. It's traditional society. Sometimes women are the enablers of this kind of tempering women's growth. Let's say a woman goes to college, finishes 4 years of education, and usually it's the mother who actually pushes for a girl to get married in her second year, first year, third year of university, or as soon as she graduates. I think this a lot of these conversations, I mean, mothers need to change also. Quotas, I mean, when we talk about changes, the changes have to come from both sides. From top, quotas are good, laws are good that they're empowered, but then the society, relationships, a lot of things need to change from the bottom as well, among women in themselves as well.
I know you have an intervention, Jen. Feel free to add it. Also, Omida is kind of talking about need for a landslide change in the society for women to play their deserved political roles in the country. So what will it take to have the type of change Omida is talking about? Where would this even start?
Well, if we look at the change that went, you know, this argument of retraditionalization and moves backwards, we want to understand a move forward, let's understand this alleged move backwards, right? And this is where I question this concept of retraditionalization, because how much of, if this thing changed so quickly, if we look at history sort of in a big picture, if things move so quickly, how real was this change? Or how much of this, you know, untraditionalization was actually coerced? The state had enormous power and the use of violence to promote women in the public sector, and it did so. And how much of that was tokenism? So it looks like things have moved in a different direction, but actually how meaningful was women's representation to begin with? And if you look at some of the work I've done in Afghanistan, women say, and actually we interviewed a lot of men, and men say, like, we're not included in this process. Like, we want to support women, but no one talks to us. So these gender issues become very divisive, because we're not part of the conversation. It becomes us versus them. And if you know, spending time in the former Soviet parts of Central Asia, words like gender, right, have almost become discredited in a way. They're seen as imports. They're seen as Western terms rather than something that comes from within. So when people start talking about gender in the post-Soviet space, it almost becomes like a lecture to people. It's like, oh, okay, we have to do that, right? Without the understanding of the meaning of the term or, you know, where it comes from, it becomes like a slogan. And so how meaningful is change when it's either imposed by donors or suggested or induced by donors without the meaning underlying social change? So one of the really interesting things that I've seen, like in Uzbekistan just recently, on social media has opened up, right? And people are now having these really open discussions. This past week, a local political movement called Yuksalish, which is very active on social media, it's run by a member of parliament, and this group is really trying to actively promote political change in the country and reform-minded and promoting civil society, and they're really genuine reformers. And they posted a list of the top 35 politicians in Uzbekistan, young politicians, to prepare for the parliamentary elections. And on the top 35 list, three were women, and one was the daughter of the president.
Sure, but how to achieve this transformation, Jen? That's the question. This change, I mean, where would this start? And I understand here on the stage, no one is satisfied from the current political role of women in the society, but what has to happen to achieve this? I mean, where this change needs to begin, where would even this start?
So, but what is the change? The change isn't, so we can't see women's participation in politics as the outcome that we want. And this is where I get nervous when we're measuring the number of people. Women, they could do meaningful things. What is the, do women's households, women, you see migration. Do women-headed households have access to the same level of energy and electricity and gas and water that households headed by men have? What are the outcomes for women? How does political leadership actually translate into the kind of equal access that women's headed households, for example, deserve? So having these conversations, women, Uzbek women criticizing these top 35 politicians to me is much more meaningful than a quota imposed from above, because they're actually having real conversations, fighting amongst themselves. These are the stakes. This is what's at stake for society.
Thanks, Jen. I think we also need to be wrapping up the discussion very quickly, but I see, Muhira, you are raising your hand. So why not you grab a microphone and say what you have in mind?
I just wanted to the point on retraditionalization, I would also kind of be very cautious when we use this type of terminology, because what we actually observed in the 90s and 2000s was the coming of the neoliberal economy, right? We're living under neoliberal capitalism now in Central Asia as the rest of the world. And what we see actually is the kind of the rolling back of the welfare state and this active kind of promotion of, traditional roles for women, right? So it was a result of deliberate policy to, you know, have women back at home, have women back, you know, performing the reproductive labor, which the state is no longer supporting or recognizing. So there's an American scholar of socialism, Christine Gozzi, who published a book called Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism and Other Arguments in Favor of Economic Equality. So she actually kind of makes a very good case of how socialism is, you know, good for women's rights, right? Because women are not forced to stay in abusive relationships. They have an income of their own. They have a system of kindergartens and schools and friendly workplaces. They have educational opportunities, etc. So and that also translates, among other things, into a more satisfying sex life. So.
Earlier, someone pointed at women's role in the economy. I just wanted to say that in Turkmenistan, they are the makers and shakers. I think when you listen to NPR, you often hear an advertisement saying, America runs on donut. So it's very true on some level in Turkmenistan. So the country really run on female entrepreneurs. If you fly over through Istanbul Airport, you get just a glimpse of women's contribution into the economic life of Turkmenistan. So we really need to be wrapping up the discussion really quickly. Let's do it with you, Jen. I see you are raising your hand.
I actually, this is a really very important point. And so one of the, I think, consequences that we've seen in Afghanistan, for example, is there's been such a push to get women in the public sector, but you don't see them to the same extent as entrepreneurs. And that was actually something that's come up a lot in our research, is that, like, how sustainable is this if women are not part of the economic production process? It's a really good question, and I think in throughout the Soviet republics of Central Asia, you do see women who are much more active as entrepreneurs. But are there glass ceilings, right? Are there glass ceilings to their ability to rise? We don't see a lot of women oligarchs, right?
Yeah, absolutely not. Jen, you often also give examples of progress in Afghanistan in terms of women's empowerment. Is there any model to be copied from there to Central Asia?
I think education. I mean, I think former Soviet Central Asian republics have learned many of these lessons, and it's about education. But I do think that where my concern about the rollbacks for women is that it's seen as such an outside force by so many that it seemed, you know, how long can this... There's so many parallels to me, I think I've said it before, to the Soviet system, except rather than it's the Soviets, it's the donors. And I think we have to be very cautious. But there's, I mean, very active women in politics now, but I think the parallels to what we've known from before are actually quite striking. So I'm not sure how much we actually want to draw on Afghanistan as an example, but I'd be curious to hear from our colleagues here what they think.
Sarah, last word from you.
So the one thing that I think we haven't talked about as much is how women act, you know, once they are actually in these positions of power.
Yeah.
It's come up a little bit. But one of the things that comes out of the comment from the audience as well is that a lot of times these women are amazing when they actually succeed in these very difficult environments, right? So there are a lot of hurdles stacked against them becoming participating in government. And many of the women that actually do are, in fact, very active once they get there. And some of the things that I've looked at when I've looked at how deputies in the Jhagolpi Pradesh are behaving is just how active these women are. They tend to vote against legislation, be more critical of legislation than men. They tend to vote together on issues. So there is this sense of, you know, women voting together on issues and that they perhaps care about in particular. And despite the low level of representation of the 1,300 odd bills that have been initiated by deputies since 2010, 44% of them have had at least one woman as an initiator on those bills. So they are also active in writing legislation. Now, some of this may be tokenism, and I don't want to overstate how active they are, but I think we need to give credit to the women who are, in fact, succeeding in these very difficult positions, and be that in government or be that as entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs.
Thank you, Sarah Hummel, visiting professor at the Harvard University. Big thanks goes to Jennifer Murtazashvili, political science professor at the University of Pittsburgh, Mohira Sayarkulova, researcher in LGBT activist from Kyrgyzstan, Umida Hashimova, researcher and writer with the Strategic Studies Division of CNA, and originally from Uzbekistan, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi, and sorry, because of the connection, we couldn't enjoy Bruce's comments as much as we usually do. So thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, media manager for South and Central Asia. And this week we were live from the annual conference of Central Eurasian Studies Society from George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.